They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies. I'm your host, Elliot Moglianes, joined as always by my co-host, Nathan Moglianes. This is our first recording from our new location in Kansas City. If I'm talking a little strangely, a little more quietly, it's because I'm still not 100% sure of the thickness of the walls and the floor in my place, so I don't know how loud I can be without waking anyone up. But anyway, Nathan, recently Disney held their D23 event thingy, wherein a lot of slop was announced. What's your reaction to some of the stuff we had? Daredevil Born Again trailer, they announced Toy Story 5, Kill Me, they announced Incredibles 3, some kind of Inside Out TV show thing. There was something about beavers. What you got?
Is that the official subtitle for Toy Story 5? Kill Me? Is that?
I think so, yes.
No, I absolutely agree with your description of it as slop. It's a lot of the same things. They announced a sequel to almost every successful property they've had in the last decade. None of which are sequels that I think are necessary or I'm excited to see. The original things they showed, the beaver thing that you referenced, looks so aggressively generic that I can't be excited about it at all because it sounds like it's just so by the numbers and basic. Some of the other stuff that Disney showed, you know, they're still making these terrible live-action remakes of their own movies that no one needs, that they don't do anything to further the cinematic vision. James Cameron was there to announce the third Avatar's title. I think Ellie and I have made it pretty clear that we're not huge fans of this Avatar series. I don't think it's been a very exciting franchise. I don't agree with people who think it's pushing the technological boundaries. I think there's way more movies that are doing way more in way less gosh dang time to push the technological barriers and borders of cinema. You know, just movies that don't take a decade to be made. Marvel, don't care. A lot of the stuff they announced, I'm not really excited for. The Fantastic Four movie might be good. I kind of like the cast. I like the Fantastic Four characters. Probably the only thing I'm genuinely excited for is they did announce some stuff and show some stuff, I think, that is not available online for Andor Season 2. Very excited for this. I loved Andor Season 1. If you're a Star Wars fan and you think Star Wars is dead, watch Andor. It's so good. But otherwise, yeah, I had little to no reaction to a lot of the nonsense they announced and showed off.
Yeah, I agree. This could not be less appealing to me. Like, Toy Story 5, guys, come on. It's time to let it go. Incredibles 3, like, I didn't love Incredibles 2. Obviously, I have a lot of fondness for the original. I'm not sure what they're going to do. I guess we'll see. Daredevil Born Again, like, they're doing everything they can to try to convince people, like, oh, it's going to be just like the Netflix series that you loved so much. I'm very skeptical of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even if it is, I mean, I feel like the Marvel, and this is sort of how I felt about Star Wars before watching Andor, so I could be completely proven wrong, but I feel like the Marvel Universe has just gotten too big to have the kind of small scale, gritty, really, really good drama that the Daredevil show had. And I think it's pretty telling that they're not trying to bring back any of the other Netflix shows, like Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, Iron Fist. Because the universe is already so big and there's so much nonsense in it. There's so many interconnected stories that have not led anywhere. I saw recently someone listing everything that has yet to be followed up on in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's an insane number of things. I know in the original phases, it took, you know, 5 or 6 years maybe to get some closure on things. But like, Vulture showed up at the end of Spider-Man Homecoming and he hasn't done squat. Not Vulture, Scorpion. Sorry, my bad. But anyway, yeah, I'm not excited about it. Not excited about it at all.
Well, in some quick other news, first of all, in terms of the blog, there's not going to be a new post this week because I was just very busy moving, but there is something very special for the blog coming up next week, so be sure to check that out. And then also, Alien Romulus. It's out now. I am actually planning on seeing it today because I got to find reasons to get out of the apartment and be in life. It's getting pretty strong reviews. Nathan, are you planning? You're planning on seeing this, right?
Yeah, I'm very interested in seeing this. I have, as you know, just part of my, I'm going to keep bragging about how many movies I've seen. I've seen every Alien movie except for Alien versus Predator Requiem, which I'm trying desperately to find so I can watch.
That's the best one, Nathan.
I know, that's what I've heard. But yeah, I'm very interested in seeing Alien Romulus. I think a lot of the reviews have posed that the movie is maybe a little divisive, that it has a kind of a third act that splits viewers, that some people are like, well, that's sick, that's such an amazing cool thing, and some people are like, wow, what a stupid hackneyed choice to do that. I don't know what it is. I have seen some stuff about kind of early plot developments that make me go, oh, that's, this movie is maybe not as back to basics as I originally thought and as the original trailers kind of tried to sell it on. So I'm very interested in seeing it. I don't know if I'm going to see it today or if I'm going to have to maybe see it on Monday, Tuesday, something like that. But definitely something I'm interested in seeing.
All right. Well, let's get her started. let's dive in, as Nathan loves to say. So this week we are doing Apocalypse Now. This is a movie that's released in 1979, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It's very, very well regarded these days. It was a little bit divisive on its release, but these days you can find a lot of people saying that it's like one of the best war movies ever made, one of the best movies ever made, period. If you didn't know, it's like very loosely based. It, like Nathan and I were talking about this earlier, and I said I wouldn't even call it based on Heart of Darkness, just like inspired by Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
It's about a captain in the army in Vietnam who is sent down a river to assassinate a colonel who has gone rogue, Colonel Kurtz. Nathan, give us what's your history with this movie? What did you think when you first saw it? And give us your first impression this time around.
Yeah, so my experience with this movie is pretty minimal. I've only seen it the once. This was one of those movies that I watched back in, I think, probably high school, beginning of college, as I was really starting to get into movies. And my reaction to it was I liked a lot of it, but the movie, in my opinion, slowed to an absolute crawl at points, plot-wise, and just felt like it took forever to end in a way that I didn't really enjoy. This time, I do have to apologize. This is one of those movies from the 70s that there's a couple of different versions of, and the only version I was able to get my hands on was the Redux version that was released in 2000 that features 49 minutes of extra content. So I'm going to try and ignore those 49 minutes as much as I can, because some of them were for sure losing the thread of what I felt was compelling about the movie. But I think my experience with the movie this time was largely the same as my initial experience, that I was really enjoying the movie for the first hour, hour and a half, that I thought the little vignettes that Willard, the captain who's sent to assassinate Kurtz, the little vignettes that he experiences as he goes down the river were very compelling, did a very good job to me of depicting his gradual sort of alignment with the same philosophy that Kurtz ends up having. But then again, I think the movie really drags in the back half of the film. I think it just really fails to maintain its momentum. I think it's really telling if you've ever read The Heart of Darkness. The Heart of Darkness is not a very long book. It's like maybe 170 to 200 pages. I knocked it out in about a day and a half or so. And I think that is because while it's a very powerful, it has a very powerful idea at its heart, it's not an idea that necessarily needs a huge amount of extrapolation or expansion. And so I think this movie, it just kind of runs out of the ability to draw new ideas out of its main idea, in my opinion. So I came away with a somewhat similar feeling. I think I liked the first hour probably more than I did the last time, and I think I disliked the last section a little bit less. I liked it more this time, but I still think there's pacing issues and there's just not enough meat on the movie's bones to sustain the runtime that it has.
Interesting. So my experience with this movie is pretty similar because we watched it for the first time together. And I remember how excited we got to hear the "I love the smell of napalm in the morning" line. And then after that, I watched this movie like four or five times. And every time I came away with a different opinion on it. Like, sometimes I really liked it. Sometimes I was less enamored. So the reason I wanted to do this movie, in addition to just like talking about it, is I wanted to like actually have a firm opinion on it. And I think I'm in kind of a similar place to you, Nathan, not necessarily for the same reasons. I think that this movie definitely has some very compelling vignettes, like you said. It's got some undoubtedly powerful images, like the shot of Willard rising through the muck at the very end. That's iconic for a reason, because that's an incredible shot. And there's some great cinematography, some incredible lighting, especially when it comes to how Kurtz is filmed. If you didn't know, this movie has one of the most hellish production stories in all of cinema. So there's so much stuff that went wrong. And one of the things that went wrong is Marlon Brando, who played Kurtz, showed up to set like 80 pounds overweight. And so he was meant to be like emaciated, like a stick figure, but that's obviously not possible now. So Coppola had to film him as like this hulking big sort of brutish figure, and also hide him in shadows to kind of disguise his weight. But I think it works. Although I think that, like you, a lot of my problems are with the ending. Not necessarily because of the pacing, but because I really think that this movie kind of undercuts a lot of its potential for, like, thematic and even just emotional impact in the way that Kurtz is portrayed, because he does really come off in this telling as insane. Mm. Not like a broken man or someone who's been kind of stripped down by the things that he's experienced. He does just kind of come across as having lost his grip on reality, which if you read the book, which I think you should, it's very, very good. Kurtz is not insane in the book. He is that kind of like man who's just been broken down by the things that he's done in the service of his, he works for an ivory trading company. So the book is set in Africa and it's about colonialism rather than war. And I think that Kurtz is so much more effective there because Kurtz in this, yeah, he just seems kind of silly and he's just like rambling this nonsense, and he is not helped by the stupid flipping journalist character who I really did not care for this time around. So yeah, I think there is a lot to like about this movie, but I think that the ending really does kind of kick the legs out from under the rest of it. So, with that out of the way, let's get started. I mean, we've basically already started. Let's talk about the first part of this movie. What do you think? What's your favorite vignette of this initial part? Because there's kind of like, in my mind, there's like the introduction, and then there's the scene where they have to get, or the part where they have to get their boat onto the river. Then there's the part with the strippers or whatever.
Playboy bunnies, Elliot.
Jeez. Yes. Sorry. Excuse me. And then there's like, they reach like the edge, basically, of American influence, where it's kind of like the front lines between the Viet Cong and the Americans, and it's total chaos. And then there's some other stuff on the river later on. But so what's your favorite part about this, this like first hour and a half that we both seem to find the most favor in?
Well, I find that funny too. I had a couple extra vignettes in my version.
Of course.
But I mostly skipped through them or was cooking dinner while they were happening to try and preserve the experience of the theatrical cut. I think the strongest vignette is definitely the time they spend with Lieutenant Kilgore, or whatever his title is, Kilgore, who is Robert Duvall's character. He is, of course, the man who says, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning." And I feel like that just starts the movie off on such a strong foot, because the movie is very kind of trippy. It has a very particular way of filming Vietnam that I think has seeped into the way almost everyone else films Vietnam, where it feels like an acid trip. It feels like everything's very hazy, nothing's really concrete, which I think on a technical level, the movie looks incredible, and its look and feel are perfectly enmeshed with the tone of the story that it's trying to tell. And I think kind of the tone, and this is kind of some of the lines I wrote down that emphasize this, that at the very beginning, when Willard is sent down on this mission, he makes the comment that charging someone with murder here is like handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500. That there's a sense in which Kurtz's break with reality is not as special as the military is trying to make it seem. That in Willard's opinion, Kurtz is just as insane as some of the other people who are still, right, actively doing military stuff. That Kurtz's only issue is that he stopped obeying the people above him. nothing he's doing is that far afield. And I think the vignette with Kilgore perfectly illustrates that, because Kilgore is a crazy character. I mean, he decides to agree to take them to the mouth of the river because he hears the surfing there is really good. And that's an insane reason for someone to be like, yeah, we'll attack a position that I think is, you know, swarming with enemy and very difficult to capture because I think I can surf there. And then he's got people actively surfing as the battle is still going on. And, you know, just the way he acts is so clearly insane. And I think it drives this idea that Willard has, where he's like, what exactly has Kurtz done that is so evil? If he's kind of acting, if, you know, there's people like Kilgore who have faced no repercussions or have faced no pushback for their actions. Like, what? And I wrote a very edgy Nietzsche sort of line that it's not from the movie, but just the thought that I had, where the only rational response to insanity is to go insane. That I think impressed upon Willard throughout this journey that he has is this sense where it's like, okay, if the things that are being said as like rational and this makes sense, this is the normal way of going about things, if those don't make sense, why would you maintain rationale? Like, what, why would you rationally say, I'm gonna keep doing this stuff? And I think the sequence with Kilgore is the strongest. I love Robert Duvall as Kilgore. Obviously, the Ride of the Valkyries scene is incredibly iconic. And then just on a technical level, I know that the filming of this movie was a huge mess. I desperately want to see The Heart of Darkness, which is the documentary that someone made while Coppola was struggling to finish this movie. But the action set pieces here with Kilgore are incredible. Apparently, the military would not give Coppola any military helicopters or anything like that. So all of these helicopters, he's basically like buying from people. He's like finding ways to get helicopters. And this is one of those movies where, because it's made before like CGI or really special effects, when he's got, you know, people walking around with like 20 helicopters flying around in the background, shooting and exploding things, he really had to have a whole battle taking place in the background of these characters walking around, which is just insane to me. I mean, again, the filming of this movie is crazy. And it seems to me like he did just literally go into the Philippines and start blowing stuff up with no, like, without asking anyone if he could do that. But I think, to kind of bring myself back to your original question and my point, I think this opening sequence with Kilgore has the strongest, presents the idea of the movie the strongest of any of the other vignettes. That the other vignettes still have this sense of, wow, this is like, this is not normal, and it's being treated as normal, and so why would Kurtz not break with what's considered normal if, you know, the reality he's being asked to accept is insane? I think there's a line Kurtz has near the end where he's, like, recording something that he's like, you know, we have airplanes flying out of here bombing civilian villages, and the soldiers aren't allowed to write the F word on their planes because it's obscene. Like, that's an irrational, that if you really stop and think about that, he's like, that doesn't make sense. Why would we accept that? And I think this sequence with Kilgore perfectly illustrates that idea.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the movie is definitely at its thematic strongest when it's really digging into that very much imagined distinction between Kurtz and the rest of the army. And I think that the Vietnam War has got to be like the perfect setting for this critique of warfare, because the Vietnam War, if somehow you didn't know, is like is a conflict that's famous for being very chaotic, lots and lots of war crimes being committed. And yeah, that is one of my favorite lines from Kurtz, is when he's talking about them not being allowed to write bad words on their airplanes that are being used to murder people. So I think that's really good. And I do really like Kilgore as a character, because yeah, he is totally off his rocker. Like the one scene where they've got this injured Viet Cong soldier, and Kilgore, it seems like he's about to do something very noble and very honorable, because the injured Viet Cong wants water and nobody wants to give it to him. And Kilgore is like, any man who's got the guts to fight with his own guts hanging out, he can drink from my canteen any day. And then it's like a really great moment of dark comedy where somebody says like, hey, Lieutenant, isn't that Lance something or other, this like famous surfer? And so before he gives the Viet Cong his water, Kilgore just like stands up. He's like, what? Where? And as he's standing up, the water from his bottle is like pouring all over the guy's face. So that's really dark comedy, but it's really effective because like, yeah, this dude is nuts. And Willard even mentions like, if I'm going to kill Kurtz, like, why am I not going to kill Kilgore? And the idea basically is that Kurtz has, it's not that he's like done anything that the military doesn't necessarily want him to do. It's that he just doesn't like ask them for permission. They can no longer control him. So yeah, I think that's really good. My personal favorite vignette, I think, is one of the later ones, the one where they reach the edge of the American lines. It's late at night, and it's centered around a bridge that the Viet Cong is attacking and the Americans are trying to defend. And I think it's really good at establishing this atmosphere of total chaos, because Willard gets off the boat to try to find the commanding officer, and everyone is saying, like, well, you were the commanding officer. Like, he goes up to this one person who's shooting, like, I don't know, a mounted gun, and firstly, he says, like, what are you shooting at, soldier? And the soldier, sorry, I'm just gonna turn off my phone. That's very unprofessional of me. The soldier initially is like, oh, he's cursing him out. And then he's like, oh, sorry, sir, I'm shooting at the Viet Cong. And then he's like, who's the commanding officer? And the soldier's like, aren't you the commanding officer? So yeah, and then this is one of those moments. There's another moment where some guy has to shoot a grenade launcher to kill a Viet Cong who's making fun of them. And Willard asks him, do you know who the commanding officer is? And the guy says yes, and then walks away. And I kind of like that, because it does contribute to this, like, this sense that this is total lawlessness and no one has any idea what's going on. But also, it kind of strains my suspension of disbelief, because I'm like, Willard, do you not have any follow-up questions for that guy? I thought you were trying to find commanding officer. So when he says yes, why are you just staring at him as he walks away? So that's a little silly. But I think it's really good and really powerful. And again, we have this idea that this is all pointless, because the guy who drives the boat, his name is Chief, I think, or yeah, his call sign is Chief, says, like, We keep on building this bridge, and the Viet Cong just keep on blowing it up, all so that the generals can say that the roads are open, or something along those lines. And I think it's really effective. And again, a lot of this is complemented very well by the filmmaking. And we shouldn't not acknowledge that some of the filmmaking that went on was negligent to the point of being criminal. Like, you should not be napalming forests without asking for permission. You shouldn't be slaughtering live cows on camera. But in this case, I think, yeah, like, the lighting in this movie is really good, because this is at night, obviously, and so a lot of it is just, like, light from flares. And it's kind of like the scene in 1917, where the soldier is going through the ruined town at night, and so the flares keep on coming up and lighting up the scene. And so that basically happens here, and it creates such a lovely contrast of these bright lights and these deep shadows just kind of playing across people's faces and the scene in general, bless you, that I was just soaking it in. I was like, that just, it just looks incredible.
Yeah, and I think, to kind of dive deeper into, I didn't mean to say dive there, the technical elements, I think the visual language of this movie is amazing. I already mentioned that the film feels like an acid trip. It feels very surreal, and there's so many moments that are incredibly surreal. When they come across the place where the Playboy bunnies are going to come to perform for the GIs, it's bizarre. It feels unreal. It feels like they've wandered into purgatory or some sort of another plane. And I think it's so, so well done. Like you said, the colors, the lighting of the film. I don't know if you, we both live in the Midwest, so occasionally when like Montana's on fire or like Canada is having really big forest fires, the smog will make its way all the way down to us, and it looks the same as some of the scenes in this movie, where there's just so much fog and fire and just like random things, you know, burning and being blown up, that everything looks really hazy and yellow. And I think it's telling in a sea of iconic Vietnam movies. I think Apocalypse Now probably contributes the most iconic visual, like, shots or motifs to the Vietnam movie kind of landscape, I think. I mean, Platoon has, what, the one of the guy getting shot. Full Metal Jacket has the one of the guys climbing, you know, with the sunset behind them. But Apocalypse Now has, like you said, the shot of Willard rising from the mud, all of the shots of Kurtz in, you know, just engulfed in these shadows, looking so much. It was also fun to watch this because I can very clearly see how they were inspired by Kurtz in this movie in the way they filmed Baron Harkonnen in the most recent Dune movies. That it's, again, just a giant man filmed in shadows. But yeah, the visual language of the movie does so much to complement the story, that the story is trying to highlight how surreal and irrational this conflict is and this entire setting. And so the fact that the movie looks kind of trippy and weird helps that greatly, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's all good. I want to take a minute to talk about the characters in this movie, because we've got our main character, Willard, played very capably by Martin Sheen. You've got Lawrence Fishburne, yes, playing Mr. Clean. Some people I don't know playing the other characters, but on the boat, there's Willard, Mr. Clean, Chef, who's, I think they're Gunner, something like that. Yeah. Lance, I don't know what his deal is. And then Chief, who drives the boat. And I think they make up a nice little ensemble. I think it's very effective to contrast the, like, camaraderie that the crew shares with the isolation of Willard. He doesn't really get along. It's not that he doesn't get along with them. It's that he just doesn't really fit in with them. They don't, like, joke around. He's just kind of doing his own separate thing. Because the people on the boat do not know what the mission is for most of the movie. They think that, well, they don't know. And I don't think that any of the crewmen are like particularly compelling. Lance survives for the longest, but I'm not sure why, because he basically just goes insane and starts acting like a complete idiot. I have no idea what's happening with Lance. He kind of frustrated me, to be honest. I was like, what's going on with this guy? But anyway, and then you've got Chef and Mr. Clean and Chief, and they're all well acted. And again, I think that they're a good contrast for Willard, but there's nothing like super engaging about them. And in fact, sometimes I found them a little bit cloying, especially when Mr. Clean dies at one point while a tape from his mother is being played. And so over his death, we can hear his mother talking about all the things that she wants to do with him once he gets back and how happy she's going to be to see him. And rather than finding that like devastating, I was kind of like, all right, really? That feels very staged. So they're by no means bad, but I guess I just don't have a lot to say about them. But I am interested to hear if you have anything to say about them, Willard or the crewmen.
I like Willard quite a bit. I agree that Martin Sheen, I think he does a really good job here in this movie. And I think especially the voiceover narration does a lot and very, very much adds to the character of Willard, that we can hear him having some doubts about his mission, having some doubts about Vietnam in general. Although apparently Martin Sheen did not do all the voiceover for this because he was unavailable by the time Coppola finished editing the movie together. So his brother or something provides some of the voiceover, and Coppola genuinely, because he was kind of on drugs as he was making this movie, has no idea which voiceover sections are Martin Sheen and which are his uncredited brother. Which, again, if it's not clear by now, this movie was crazy. The filming of this movie was nuts. But yeah, I like Martin Sheen quite a bit. And I found myself enjoying the stuff on the boat much more than I remember enjoying it the first time around. And I actually found that scene of Clean dying, I found it reasonably affecting. I wasn't, like, devastated. I wasn't, like, crying. But I didn't think it felt staged. It felt very natural that they had just received mail. They were all, you know, reading their mail stuff or listening to it if they got tapes like Clean did. And then they got attacked. And I think especially the boat people help, again, reinforce an idea that's being presented by the narration and by Willard's examination of Kurtz, that one of the things Kurtz says is, a lot of the people being sent here aren't people who should be in a war zone. They're people, you know, they're just normal people who are kind of being forced to do things that they wouldn't normally do. And there's a great scene where, I love how unsubtle it is, where as he's reading something about Kurtz, where it's like, these are all just, you know, good old Johnny boys who love their rock and roll. As he's saying that, a Rolling Stones song comes on over the radio, and everyone in the boat's like, oh, sick, it's the Rolling Stones. Like, we love this. And so they're all just, you know, singing along to a rock song as Kurtz is saying, like, hey, I don't think these are the people who should be in a war zone. And then I think I don't know if this scene is in the theatrical version, but there's a scene where they stop a boat full of indigenous people, of, you know, just civilians going about their day. They stop the boat because Chief wants to do a search of the boat to see if they're carrying any contraband or carrying anything for the Viet Cong. And Clean gets kind of trigger happy because someone makes a quicker move than he's comfortable with, and so he kills everyone on the boat. And it turns out they were just trying to protect a dog or something. But again, it really enforces this idea that it's like, these are not people who should be in a war zone. These are not people who should be in a combat zone that is as stressful and chaotic as Vietnam. And Willard even says that. He's like, these are not the people we want to... This is insane to think that we could win a war like this with people like this. Which, again, just pushes him further towards adopting the same position that Kurtz has.
Yeah. And he does, Willard does contrast that with the Viet Cong when he says that their only way home is dying or being victorious. Mm-hmm. And it's so clear, like the Viet Cong, obviously we can talk about the historical motivations and character of the Viet Cong, but I don't think it's too controversial to say that the Viet Cong have a lot more to lose in this fight than America did. And I think that that scene is in the theatrical version. And I think that, again, it does a really good job of, like we keep on saying, hammering home this point about insanity. That so they shoot all the people in the boat, and then there's a woman who's wounded but still alive. And they're like, oh, we can get her to someplace and help her out, give her some medical attention. And Willard, because he wants to keep on going on his mission, just shoots her. And then everyone's all horrified, and it's such a, like, it is just such an insane contrast of, like, they've just gunned down a bunch of innocent people, and then Willard does the exact same thing in a slightly different context, and they're like, oh my gosh, how could you do that, you monster? When they just, every single one of them just murdered a bunch of people themselves.
Yeah. No, it's very good. Well, I think maybe let's bring it home here. Let's talk about the ending. Marlon Brando as Kurtz. I kind of already said my thoughts. I think the ending takes too long. I think I kind of agree with your point, too, that Kurtz does not represent all of the things that he's purported to, especially that the journalist character is purported, that he's like, he's a genius. He's, you know, ascended. He's somehow reached some higher elevation of knowledge. And then he starts talking, and it's just like, yeah, he's kind of saying the same stuff Willard's been saying. Like, this doesn't feel like that brand new. It doesn't feel like Kurtz is really presenting a new facet to the stuff that, I mean, it feels like Willard has already gotten to the heart of what Kurtz's issues are, and it doesn't feel like Kurtz provides any new insight into those things. Honestly, I feel like the movie would almost be better if Willard gets to the end and discovers that Kurtz is already dead, and that it's just a bunch of people who are still kind of carrying on his ethos, because that, at the very least, then that would be an interesting contrast or an interesting development. Whereas this is just Willard gets there, Kurtz says some stuff that does seem like he is kind of insane and is kind of nuts, and not just, like, you know, rationally trying to deal with the insanity that's around him. And then Kurtz gets... it takes so long for Willard to decide to kill Kurtz that it just really irritates. It doesn't feel like the movie ends as fast as it should. This is also the section where you get to see a cow die on screen for real, which is a crazy thing to have in a movie. Yeah, and I also think a lot of Marlon Brando's performance is just made by the way Coppola chooses to film it and Coppola's team, that if it was just Brando as a, you know, a big fat guy sitting there pontificating about Vietnam, this would not be as good, and no one would be saying that Marlon Brando's performance is amazing. It's made by the way in which it's shot, which is good. Again, I'm not saying that as like, oh, it's not shot well. It's shot so well that I think it's kind of carrying what is, in my opinion, a fairly mediocre sort of finale of the character.
Wow, interesting. I would have to disagree. I think that Marlon Brando's performance is pretty good in this movie. And like I said, I do love the way that he's shot. It's just the problem with this ending and the reason that it takes so much off of the score for me is that it just feels very anticlimactic. Not because I wanted a like big shootout with lots of explosions at the ending, but because I want the build-up to meet Kurtz, I think it's really well done, where he's constantly kept in the foreground of the audience's mind. Like, Kurtz is coming. Oh my gosh, what's it going to be like? What's he going to say? And then the stuff that he says is kind of just nonsense. Like, he's just kind of rambling word salads for a lot of the time that he's there. And so that's the anticlimax, as like Kurtz has been built up as this kind of larger-than-life ruined man who's really got something to say, like philosophy wise, and then he's just kind of quoting T.S. Eliot poetry and talking to Willard about, and just like telling Willard stories about his life, which is not what I was in for. And again, I have to say, this is not helped by the photojournalist character, who just seems high. Why is that? It's because Dennis Hopper, the actor, was high on cocaine for, like, every shot that he's in.
Hey, well, good news, so was Coppola.
Yeah, the cocaine business in the Philippines must have had a really red-letter year when this movie was being made. But yeah, I think that Kurtz is just such a letdown. And again, I can't help but compare him to his book counterpart, where he's not insane. He's just like, he's just realized the absurdity and the evil that he's a part of as an ivory trader in Africa in like 1899 or something. Or maybe it's a little bit later than that, or earlier than that. And that's just kind of ruined him. And his last words in the book are the same as in the movie. His last words are, the horror, the horror. And it's so much more impactful there because Kurtz, the book does a much better job of characterizing Kurtz and letting us get into his head than the movie. That when he says that in the book, you're like, you're kind of like, yeah, dude, that is horrific. This has been a really bad situation. But when Kurtz says it in the movie, I'm just like, what are you talking about, man? What are you talking about? And like, maybe that's on me. Maybe I'm just stupid and I don't understand it. But like I keep on saying, I can only evaluate the movie as I experience it. And that was my experience with Kurtz, is that I found him very much a letdown and kind of just a guy who's just a bit silly.
Yeah. Well, and the movie takes, and this is kind of, we're just talking about negatives now. I think the movie is just too long, and I understand that I watched a longer version, and I don't feel like any of the scenes that were added, there's a scene with like a French rubber plantation that is, again, very surreal and emphasizes the surreal nature of the conflict. But it doesn't feel like it lands, it expands that surrealness to any meaningful sort of degree. There's also another scene where they come across the Playboy bunnies again, and the guys get to hang out with them more, which again is a weird scene, but I don't feel like it, and you know, emphasizes just the bizarre nature of the conflict, but it doesn't feel like a lot of these vignettes extend our idea. They're just another example of an idea the movie's already presented. That the movie presents the idea that the Vietnam conflict is chaotic and insane, and so it'd be hard to maintain your sanity in an environment like that. And then the movie just keeps giving us more examples of that same thing. Which is not like the worst thing, but when the movie's 3 hours long and all it has to give me is more examples of something I already kind of agreed with to begin with, it can feel like the movie's just plodding along slowly, you know, trying to get to what I've already said is a kind of disappointed climax for me. Because I also feel like I don't have a strong grasp of why Willard decides to kill Kurtz in the end, and why Willard doesn't. You know, what will it feels like an ambiguous ending, and not in like a satisfying, oh, his character arc is done sort of way, and more in like a, this is just how it ends. So I think, yeah, the pacing, I was not enraptured for every moment of this film. There were large chunks of this movie where I was like, come on now, let's, can this boat not go faster?
Yeah, this movie does have a habit of, I think, getting in its own way. Where it's like, all right, you've done all this. It's been good. You've set this up really well. Now is the time to like downshift, or even just like change gears and kind of shake it up a little bit. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot else to say. This movie, does it have any music aside from like diegetic music?
I don't think, if it does, it's just music that shows up in like the back half that I think was good in terms of it's very unsettling sort of music, I'm seeming to remember. But yeah, it doesn't have a ton, and most of the most famous musical moments are using other pieces.
Excuse me. Yeah, we've already talked about the cinematography and the lighting, both of which are top-notch. This movie's just, it's kind of hard for me to evaluate because there's so much about it that I do think is genuinely great, and yet I feel like it fails to bring it home, to wrap it all up in a bow, and instead just kind of peters out, which is unfortunate, but yeah, the rest of the movie is so good that it's hard for me to know where to land.
Well, I know where to land, so I'll go first with my rating, and hopefully you figure out how you feel. Yeah, but like we already said, I think the movie is so good in so many ways, and I would not say this is a movie that I think is undeserving of the acclaim it gets. I just think a lot of that acclaim doesn't connect with me because I find the movie a little slower. I don't think the ending is as strong as other people. I think if the ending did resonate with me more, I think I would be in a similar camp to a lot of the people who praise this movie, because I think a lot of its strongest qualities of the philosophical questions of, you know, how do you rationally respond to things that you can't put into a box very easily, and things that don't make sense to you. I think it's very strong. I think the technical elements of this movie are so fantastic, but it just doesn't land with me emotionally. It doesn't resonate with me, the ending, and it's kind of slow. It's not a movie. It's not a barn burner. So I'm going to give it a 7.6 out of 10. I think it's an above average movie for all of the qualities we've listed, but it's not as good as something like The Hurt Locker, where I feel like it's very consistently driving home a very compelling and interesting message.
Yeah. So I'm going to give this movie a B, which I think is, I didn't choose it arbitrarily, but that's like as close as I can get to how I feel about this movie. There is so much about it that's good. And I do think if you haven't seen it and you're like a movie buff, I think it is absolutely worth watching. Just so you can like put your two cents in. But I think, yeah, like I said, this movie just kind of gets in its own way and peters out in the end. But it's still worth watching. There's still a lot of stuff to like about it. Okay, let's do recommendations. I'll go first. I've already told Nathan about this. My recommendation is, for my money, what I think is the best Vietnam War movie ever made, and that's Full Metal Jacket. This is a Stanley Kubrick movie, and if you didn't know, it's very well regarded. It's also about Vietnam, although it is less about the politics of the conflict than it is about the effect it has on the people who fought in it. The movie's like main idea is that it's constantly hammering home is that young men of all walks of life and with all kinds of different ideas and motivations are being broken down and turned into an assembly line of just unthinking, unfeeling, killing machines. This movie has a legendary performance by R. Lee Ermey as a drill sergeant who is kind of insane. And it's like, it's set in two halves of like, it's basically just setting up like, okay, this is how these people are being turned into unthinking, unfeeling, killing machines. And then this is what that looks like actually in the field. Because it's set, the first half is set in boot camp. And then the second half is set in Vietnam. And I think it's really good. I think some people think that the two halves don't gel very well together. I personally am of the opinion that they work really well, that they complement each other really well. It's got great performances. I love the ideas that it's playing with and the way that it plays with them. This is one of my favorite Kubrick movies, so I would absolutely say give it a watch if you liked Apocalypse Now or if you didn't like Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, I could definitely second that. I think your analysis of that movie too makes me like it kind of a bit more. Maybe I need to rewatch it. Anyway, I'm going to recommend another movie that I feel very similarly to Apocalypse Now about, in that I have some hesitations with it personally, but I think it has such a strong thematic center. And it's also a movie that's somewhat inspired by The Heart of Darkness. It's much more about colonialism than about a conflict, per se. And this is Werner Herzog's Aguirre, The Wrath of God, which follows a group of, I think they're supposed to be Spaniards, some conquistadors, who come to the Amazon forest, a famously difficult place to enter and survive in. And they go in there to try and claim the land for Spain. And the entire movie is kind of centered on the ridiculousness of that idea of being able to go into a place that you have no genuine control over, no genuine power over, and thinking that somehow just by nature of you being there, you have changed it and claimed it and made it something different. That nature is inherently very, very difficult for humans to control. And so thinking that just by, in my opinion, the best scene in the movie, they're just floating down the Amazon River and the guy's drawing up a map. And he's like, this is amazing. Like, our country's twice the size of Germany now. This is awesome. And it's like, what do you, haven't done anything. Like, you're just floating down and looking at it. But it's very good. It has some very funny moments. I think it's a little more tongue-in-cheek than Apocalypse Now. It has some very dark humor moments, but I think it's a very strong thematic companion to Apocalypse Now of, again, the kind of insanity inherent in some of the things that humans have done, and especially in this movie, Aguirre. It's just presented very well, and it's a very surreal movie. Again, I really like it. Elliot's about to dismiss it somewhat, but that's my recommendation.
Well, actually, since watching it, I do really like and find very interesting the things that it is saying that you were talking about. But so I think it's interesting to think about, but the movie itself is just kind of boring to me. And I don't think that the tone shifts between comedy and like, ethos work very well. So if I were being really generous, I could give this like a very hesitant second. Also, fun fact, the guy who plays the main character in that movie is like even more of a nightmare to film with than Marlon Brando, who's like legendary for being just a total diva. yeah, that guy is... He's just not a very nice person.
Interesting. Klaus Kinski, I think is his name.
Something like that. Anyway, life is hard and full of disappointments. You know it. I know it. We all know it.
Yeah. I suppose I think that might be the only rational response to the chaos. I think the other rational response is to listen to Magellan's at the Movies. If you want to cut through the noise and understand film, you got to stay tuned in, you know. So next week, yeah, we're going to have a brand new episode continuing to come from our brand new offices in Kansas City. So thanks so much for listening, and we're going to see you next week.